Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua. With guest co-host.
Zyder.
Recently where I popped a hut and it was, the villagers were in such awe that they built a lighthouse in your nearby coastal city. I was like, sweet.
You had a dream about that?
Yeah, I did.
Pretty intense, man.
Wow. Eats, sleeps, and dreams of...
Episode 70. This is Zyder here with Cardamandua, Dan Q, and Makalua.
Drinking iced coffee because it's too damn warm here already.
Mackie, you swore you said damn. I'm sure you said damn.
Say again. No.
Aww.
In news, 38 Studios makes a save and acquires Big Huge Games. Take-Two announces their second quarter results. And Civ 4 Complete is out, now with 100% less DRM.
In the Senate, we talked about civil plantations, whether we build them or if we build other things instead.
In the research lab, a new reduced military unit cost option for players who want warfare. Or not.
In forum talk, which came first, the sword or the shield? And carriers, are they ridiculous?
Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
Studios acquires Big Huge Games.
Well, this is a follow-up to a story that we talked about in episode 65 when THQ applied considerable layoffs to the studio as part of a $220 million cost-cutting initiative across all of its studios. And THQ, which had only bought the company about 14 months prior, had said, well, if we don't find a buyer within 60 days, we're just going to shut the whole thing down. And, of course, Big Huge Games, founded by four individuals, including Brian Reynolds, designer on Civilization II and Alpha Centauri, Big Huge Games behind the real-time strategy game Rise of Nations, which is probably the most notable title for our audience. Now, it appears that Big Huge Games has been saved by the axe, although I think it's important to note that what 38 Studios has done is it has picked up all of Big Huge Games' intellectual property, and that includes Rise of Nations, Rise of Legends, the unnamed role-playing game that was in progress, as well as all their rights and interests in Catan and Age of Empires III Asian Dynasties. As someone commented from the Flash of Steel article, I didn't take 38 seriously until just this moment. This is great news and from a wholly unexpected quarter from Rob Zachney. 38 Studios was founded in 2006 by Kurt Schilling. It's an entertainment and original IP creation company, quote-unquote, from their press release. It says that the acquisition is a critical step in their strategy to deliver a broad range of entertainment products centered on its original fantasy IP, codenamed Copernicus. Specific financial terms of the agreement were not disclosed. Crispy Gamer had an interview with the president and chief executive officer of 38 Studios, Brett Close, where he again said, 38 Studios is a privately held company. We do not reveal terms of deals. And discussion of specific terms and conditions of this deal are mandated confidential by contract. Brian Reynolds will continue to work with Big Huge Games in an ongoing consultant role. Just in that simple sentence, that says a lot without saying much. So to speak, like, what does that even mean? Crispy Gamer asked, will Big Huge Games return to its roots under 38 and make strategy games again? And the response was this generic answer, non-answer, which is, BHG is working on a number of great products. Look for announcements in the future about releases and dates, quote-unquote. But seeing as how they said a big part of this deal was centered on 38 Studios' original fantasy IP that they already had in development, very unlikely we're talking about Rise of Nations 2, at least their next title. One could argue that if you ever want to see Rise of Nations 2, then whatever this Copernicus product is, it had better be able to carry the studio through, so Rise of Nations 2 could perhaps see the light of day in the future.
Right. It seems to me like the only drawback from this deal might be if this Copernicus project doesn't actually end up doing a whole lot, all this talent is going to get sort of shuffled into an obscure corner of the gaming world, and then we won't get the traditional franchises. Or maybe this could end up being, you know, a really good combination of resources and talent. I don't know.
Yeah, and speaking of the talent, 38 Studios to this point has been pretty well concentrated in one physical location, and some people are suggesting, such as in response on the Gamma Sutra article, when an individual said, it'll be interesting to see how long the BHG offices remain open. They're remaining open for now, but the studio has already suffered, as I said, considerable layoffs by THQ. It's not known how many employees they have left, how deep the cuts were. Copernicus has been and will continue to be a massive undertaking for 38, and if they are better served having these resources close at hand rather than via webcam, expect 38 to return to a one-stop shop. So it could end up being, I mean, it's already been said that Big Huge Games studio will essentially be, seem almost like a satellite studio of 38. I mean, it's going to be integrated into 38 Studios. It doesn't say that the Big Huge Games brand is going to disappear, but one wonders if eventually they will go to the BHG employees that remain and say, we do have a job for you, but it's no longer in Maryland.
Yeah, that could be difficult for some of the employees to respond to, it seems like, as far as they have to travel to a new location or...
Where 38 Studios is located right now, it would be quite a move, and of course, Big Huge Games has been around since 2000. People have to get up and move. Oh, from Baltimore, Maryland to Maynard, Massachusetts, it's only 394 miles. You know, it's only a 6-hour and 51-minute commute one way. 38 has acquired all of Big Huge Games' proprietary IP, tools, technology, assets, and works in progress. Now, certainly, human resources are an asset, but as it said, wouldn't be surprised if they then said, well, you know, you do this at Big Huge Games, but we have so-and-so doing this here at 38 Studios. So between either moving or perhaps saying, well, we're going to have to lay some of you people off simply because we don't need this duplication. And, oh, by the way, we really can't afford the expense of having you guys all the way out here. It will be interesting to see how long the studio remains open and whether or not 38 Studios keep the Big Huge Games name or whether they just end up saying, well, here are the Big Huge Games titles. We own them. We'll continue to sell them and make them available, but... going forward, anything that Big Huge Games had in the pipe is now under the 38 Studios banner. But I think the big question at the moment, and I guess I don't know why Crispy Gamer didn't ask this, maybe they felt it wasn't the time, but I would have said, what do you mean by Brian Reynolds will continue to work in an ongoing consultant role?
Yeah, sometimes they use that sort of phraseology when they don't want to disappoint fans. They want to reassure people that key figure is staying on, but they don't really have a defined role to put them in right away. So, yeah, it's kind of up in the air, it sounds like.
Well, and what kind of responsibility or say would he even have over whatever projects Big Huge was working on if those are going to continue, let alone what kind of role he would have in whatever this codenamed Copernicus project is, because it already is underway.
Right.
Time will tell, but I guess for the immediate future, this is good news, but I think cautious optimism is the best I'm going to be able to go with this based on what's been said officially and also points some other people have raised. This is relatively breaking news. This was only announced 3 days prior to when we recorded this. But at least for now, Big Huge Games will live to see another day. It's a big surprise that Take-Two isn't doing as well in 2009 as they did 12 months ago. But, of course, that could be said for almost anything and everything. They announced financial results for the second quarter, ending April 30th, 2009. Net revenue was $229.7 million, compared with comparably twice that, a little more than twice that, $539.8 million for the same quarter last year. Net loss, and this is where we get a more clear picture, net loss for the second quarter was $10.1 million, or 13 cents a share, compared to a net income of $98.2 million, or $1.29 per share. The third business highlight, Sid Meier's Civilization IV, the complete edition for Games for Windows, is now available in North America from 2K Games. And Civilization IV complete edition is Civ IV with Warlords and Beyond the Sword and Civilization IV Colonization included. But I think the most notable thing about Civ IV, the complete edition, which we haven't talked about before, even though this has been news about a month now, is that Civilization IV complete edition is digital rights management free. That's right. no longer having to put the CD in the drive to play, minus getting a no CD hack. According to Elizabeth Toby, the community manager at 2K Games, Civ 4 publisher, this also package comes on a single DVD as opposed to multiple CDs in an effort to use last packaging. For all the griping that we have heard anyway about digital rights management and how annoying it can be, at least you don't have to register the product or get an account in order for the game not to be crippled or to continue to be able to be used. Digital rights management can have lots of other things involved rather than simply having the CD in the drive.
Right. One thing I've noticed is there's some sort of sub-program that monitors your computer while Civ is playing. It actually takes up a not negligible amount of RAM. So it's one other added sort of annoyance that they won't have to deal with if customers get this complete version, it sounds like.
And it's also on Steam, so you just have to wait a couple of months for the inevitable weekend sale where it's going to be $9, and then those of us that already have it can go buy the DRM-free version and say, hey, no more CDs to put in.
Yes, which would be nice. And, of course, we can say, well, you can just do the no CD hack now. Well, I'll tell you what, when it comes to multiplayer.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, or mods, yeah.
Yeah, we can get enough out of syncs through other means. We don't have to go looking for it. Okay, thanks.
Exactly.
Our one person said, aw, no fair, I spent the money getting the titles to this point. Well, yeah, if you had waited for this, then you wouldn't have been able to play it until now. While I do find it annoying in that respect, the fact that it's DRM-free is kind of like, oh, there is something that they added to it, or in this case, took away.
I mean, this just proves that Civilization products are a bit like a good bottle of wine, where they just get better with age. They get more mods, they get more support. I got in the Civ 4 after about 2 years of it being, I got a cheaper product buying it at the store, you know, and I got more mods already there. That's the nice thing about Civ, it just keeps on sort of building on itself.
Makes me wonder if Take-Two Interactive took a page from Brad Wardell at Stardock, for instance, with Galactic Civilizations and Galactic Civilizations 2 with regards to the DRM stance. To me, in the strategy field anyway, he's the most notable individual who's been quite against that. That's good. Perhaps this also sets a precedent that if and when, but surely it is a matter of when, not if, Civilization 5 comes to be, it should be DRM-free from the beginning, and if it's not, I'm pretty sure the community will point to Civilization 4 Complete Edition and remind them, quite vocally, wait a minute.
Yep, this worked this time. That's good precedent.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy. Quote of the thread was from Avenger. Silk feels so soft on my skin. Oh, hey now. Let's stay on topic. Kubu asks, does anyone build more than one silk plantation in his or her whole empire? I found it very poor compared to other plantations and usually cottage them or farm if there's a need for food and have no scruples about it. I have similar feelings about dyes, but these are slightly better, as good as town without free speech or a printing press. Just to review briefly the silk plantation, silk itself is a plus one commerce on the tile, but if you put a plantation on it, you get plus three commerce and plus one happiness, and of course it requires the calendar technology, as do all plantations. By comparison, dye, which Kubu mentions, is plus one more commerce, plus four, plus one happiness. Incense, gotta love incense. Plus five commerce and plus one happiness, particularly with all the religious buildings. Spices, plus one food, plus two commerce, plus one happiness. And sugar, plus one food, plus one commerce, and plus one happiness. And then there is one food resource that requires a plantation in order to be able to use it. Everything else is a luxury resource, and that's banana for plus two food and plus one health.
This never really crossed my mind. I just throw a plantation down there and count on probably being able to sell it for gold per turn at some point. But the micromanagement of calculating how much a town would be worth on that tile has never really occurred to me, but I guess it's something worth thinking about.
There are apparent people who are very opinionated about it in this thread. Like you said, I don't care as much about, ooh, does this give me one more gold per turn than something else does? But they have charted it out very detailed in here, I think. And they're still arguing about it. I build a lot of cottages all over, but you don't always have opportunity for a silk plantation, and it seems that there is a general consensus that in the end, it all works out to be about the same anyway.
And you've got to remember, too, if you've got two silk plantations, it's nice to have one spare one for when Sitting Bull decides to sabotage one of your plantations, and it takes a few turns to get the workers over there, and it's annoying, and yeah, it's nice to have a buffer sometimes.
Yeah, the AI really does like to use their espionage points for that. I have to say that until recently, I was always, oh, yes, I must have a plantation on there. I must have that so I can trade it with an AI. Even later on in the game, let alone in the early game, the AI is very interested in trading for these resources and will give you very decent exchanges in terms of gold per turn. But even also if perhaps you are want for, say, a healthiness resource and you could give them, say, silk for the happiness, they'd be more than interested in doing that. But came across some recent games in the past couple of months where I was confronted with the situation and taking over a city from an AI. Now, it wasn't silk, but they had dye, and they had put cottages on dye. But they had done that some turns before, and the tiles had been worked, and they were now full-blown towns, or pretty darn close to it. And as much as part of me wanted to, I started looking at it, and I thought, you know, that improvement is already there. If I were to take that and put that a die instead, that's X number of turns that a worker is going to have to do that, or two workers, if I wanted to even go with that faster, in which case I'm now using two workers, when they could be improving tiles in, say, another city or some other tiles that they hadn't worked, and I left those alone. I think the strongest argument for doing that is you can build cottages a lot sooner than you can build plantations. As long as it's within your city's fat cross, if you put a cottage on it, you can work it, and you can get the benefit of that income until perhaps later on someone would be willing to give you, as was pointed in the thread, like 15 gold a turn for it. You could, in a matter of turns, switch off that cottage, get rid of it, and have a plantation on it, whereas if you went the other way, it's not going to be so instantaneous.
Yeah, that's true. And besides, I don't know if it's just me, but I sort of have a psychological barrier against demolishing a well-developed town in any circumstance. It seems like a Civ 4 taboo to me. Something doesn't feel right about it. Those juicy 5-7 commerce.
Now, if any particular tile improvement, to change a town or to have a town of yours pillaged, that hurts more than anything because it's not just, oh, yes, a worker had to spend X number of turns to build that and then a road to hook it up, for instance, but that cottage, that improved over time. That was a time investment that you can't get back. I think it's very situational. If you have more than one, say, well, I'll go back to silk because that was the example. If you have more than one silk and none of the silks or any silks that aren't within a fat cross of a city, I'm not going to put a cottage on those if it's not going to be able to be worked. I will just have that so that I've got the added benefit of being able to trade, or as you said, Zyder, if you lose one. But if it's in my fat cross, if I've got more than one, and then if I have the ability to build plantations, then I'm going to check to see, all right, how many AIs are left? What are my trade relations with them? How much gold per turn do they have? And even if you've just got that one silk or that one luxury resource, whatever it happens to be, go to the AI and say, how much will you give me per turn for my one amount? And then they'll tell you the amount of gold. Say, forget it. But then make note of how much that is. You can go to all the AIs, find out where you can get the best deal, and then decide, okay, do I want that instantly? Do I want that instant gold per turn now? Or would I rather, for instance, deny them this resource, this happiness resource, and just build it up as a cottage and go from there?
Yeah, and I guess entirely reasonable. Sounds like a lot of work to go around to all the AIs and stuff, but if you're playing the BTS Unaltered Gameplay mod, it makes it a lot easier because it will get little notifications that so-and-so is willing to trade 4 gold per turn.
And I suppose really you wouldn't even necessarily have to contact all the AIs in a single turn. You could simply go to the whatever the hell screen that is. I'm sure I'll be lynched for not remembering the name. Where you can see, for example, how much gold per turn that they have to spend. And if they are in need of that resource or would make use of that resource, they would probably give you most, if not all, of the gold for that silk, for that dye, whatever the luxury resource happens to be that required a plantation or otherwise, as well as the banana. The only thing that I saw in this thread that we haven't really touched upon yet was from Non-Praying Mantis. You know, he's one of these people that also tends to avoid building silk plantations whenever I can. Since silk often occurs with a forest on the tile, a silk plains forest tile is one of the better ones to work when underdeveloped, one food, two hammer, one gold. When forts come around, this gives you the ability to get the silk resource and still keep the hammers and health bonus from the tile. So I will usually build these on silk, especially in hammer-poor cities. Now, that angle I had not thought before.
It's an interesting idea, just as long as the forested fort tile isn't right next to your frontier city, because those you'll want to chop right away, obviously, for defensive purposes. But yeah, that's something I hadn't thought of. It is a pretty good tile with a forest on it.
I always have my own mental block about, oh, if I put a fort on it, then I'm not going to have access to that resource. Just visually, that's what comes to mind, but that's not the case. That's good to be reminded of that.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
Something that I've been thinking about, because I just recently sort of transferred from being a marathon addict to finally weaning myself onto normal and getting used to the not having the military unit bonus production, 50% bonus to military unit production. I'm actually liking normal speed and the sort of normal military production movement. But I could definitely see why having cheaper military production, having more military units to play around with, why some people, including myself, why that's appealing.
And only in rare circumstances have I ever been on Marathon, and I've actually almost at the opposite end of the spectrum. Other than multiplayer games, when I play single-player games, I'm on quick speed. The suggestion about adding a new game option to Civ 5, interestingly, it actually says to Civ 5, not modding Civ 4, although that comes up in the process, where all military units cost 50% less. This option will make it more fun for those of us who prefer warfare over other winning avenues. Saying that in my campaigns, I notice that I'm doing better compared to the computer players when I minimize warfare. The reward of long warfare usually doesn't pay for its cost. This will allow you to build more units, and so the AI. Warfare will then be more dynamic and more involved because there will be more stacks of doom around the map from Moshe Levi. Reisman was the one that wanted it the other way, a kind of a builder improvement option, and it was sure, why not? However, after considering the points here, I'm going to have to go with Shackle and other people and disagree with the suggestion. For that very reason that you were kind of getting at, Erzider, which is, there's marathon speed. That option is already in there. Leave the other levels alone.
Yeah, I guess the one objection would be, with marathon speed, the game just takes so long. If you want a more militarily involved game without it taking a week of your life away, I guess an option, because some people like marathon speed, it was me to a certain extent, not necessarily because of the game taking longer and units being able to move more, do more complicated things per unit of time, but also because of that imply or that inherent military bonus. And so if you could just isolate that, then people could play normal games but get that same sort of tweak.
And, you know, for those people who prefer warfare over other avenues of winning, you can also play with the difficulty level you're on in addition to game speed considerations. But for those wondering about marathon speed and what exactly it's doing to the cost of things, technologies and buildings are 3 times the standard cost on normal, and units are 2 times the cost. This is used as an example here by Card Game. X building costs 90 hammers, and X unit is also 90 hammers. So on Marathon, the building costs 270 hammers, and the unit 180.
There are certain things on marathon speed, though, that compensate for that to make war actually more difficult at times, especially if you're playing on the defensive. Let's say you see a stack of 6 or 7 axemen coming at you in the classical period, and you only have like 1 archer defending your city, and let's say you don't happen to be in slavery, in the slavery civic at the time, then it takes forever to build those troops to respond, whereas on quick or normal, you can have less of a standing army and still survive because you can build them as the threats arise.
Through the course of the thread, Moshe Levi says, yes, this is very close to what I'm suggesting in terms of marathon speed. as was pointed out, TechCom slowly, but that's good for war also. And that certainly plays into some past discussions we've had, trying to think of the unit right now in terms about the time period in which Unit X usefulness is quite short because of the technologies that will improve on it come very quickly. So even if you're going for that technology trait, it's going to take you that much longer to get there. So the time period for the benefit of that particular unit is extended. Okay, the cities that I want to go after, okay, so this is the combination I want. And then perhaps by the time you've got that combination, you're ready to go, and then it's, oh, they've upgraded. They had archers, and now they have longbowmen. Of course they do. Whereas if you were in a marathon speed, it's going to take them longer to be able to go from archers to longbowmen. So the time period in which, say, axemen and swordsmen would be of particular use to go and attack is extended.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. On marathon speed, it seems like I've been able to manually build out a classical army and still have it be effective. Whereas on normal speed, I find that I just have to chop and glaive away my citizens almost immediately in order to get that tiny little window to get that decisive advantage, which in a way, I don't know if that makes the game more exciting or not, or more dynamic. It's a complicated game for that among many other reasons.
So, Emotion Levi, it sounds like that you are reasonably satisfied with the marathon answer, and I think that that's a good compromise anyway with regards to what you wanted. I also don't support the idea of this so-called 50% builder trait that Risemill suggested. In that case, if you prefer building up your cities, I know this is an extreme response, but you could select always peace. There is that option. You could always go down in difficulty level. Or, I guess probably in their case, they might want to stay on quicker speeds so they can progress more quickly through the technology tree and get to the point of having some kind of decent defense even in the face of a considerable onslaught of units. Because, as we talked about before, they may have a lot more units. Their military power might be listed as higher, but if you have the technology, particularly if you've got yourself some siege weapons, then you can decimate their once proud army relatively quickly.
Yeah, I think that builder bonus, what it would do is you could probably build pretty much every building in every city in the game and then still have some time left to build units, and you wouldn't have the sort of trade-off decisions to make that make the game interesting in the first place. Maybe that's another reason why, conversely, to not have the warfare bonus either, to just remove some of those trade-offs that make the strategy interesting.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot civ issues in the forums. Which came first, the sword or the shield, from Beeblebrox? I asked this rhetorical question, obviously. However, in Civ, it seems this is not the case. It is perfectly possible to discover and build anti-tank units long before anyone in the world even knows what a tank is. Likewise, grenadiers may be built with their advantages against riflemen many techs before knowing what a red coat looks like. Again, I rhetorically ask why. The simple answer is the Civ is too easy mob, pointing out that mechanized armies historically have repeatedly triumphed in nation versus nation conflicts isn't good enough an explanation for these people. It may be an easy tactic on lower levels for a large number of people, but please remember that quite a significant portion of people will never advance beyond noble difficulty because, much as I hate to blow sunshine up some people's backsides, Civ is a hard game such that many people will never see the likes of Monarch, Emperor difficulties because the time and investment to get that good is too large for them. So to leave a couple of tactics in that are obvious to a select elite, is this really such a bad thing? Is Civ meant to pander to a clique of people of thousands, if that? I would say not. We like the idea of going through history, matching, echoing, reenacting the trials and tribulations of history. That's real life, actual life history, note the capital H. Unquote.
Yeah, this thread stirred up a whole hornet's nest of issues.
Was it all the elite people coming out and going, hey, hey?
Yeah, Beeblebrox, you had some point in there, but unfortunately it's not just what you said, but it's how you said it. Not that I agree with what you're saying otherwise, but wow, that was not the way to go about it. I think a kind of the short response is from Aftershafter, this game has settings for everyone, quote-unquote. But he also says, you know, I don't get what you want. Do you want all difficulties to be easily accessible to all gamers? Isn't the entire purpose of difficulties to make some levels of play inaccessible to those who aren't willing to sink a great deal of time and thought into playing a game? This game is made in a manner that allows for many levels of play. I concur with that. If you never get above noble difficulty, and you're happy with that, that's great. If you are not satisfied with noble difficulty, and you're sufficiently not satisfied with noble difficulty and it being too easy for you, that you're going to continue to move up the difficulty levels and invest that time, then that's great. We don't have to agree on that. It caters to a number of different types of players, not just warmongers and builders, but also people who have different time commitment availabilities, whether that's constantly or you were available quite a bit and then you weren't able to play the game for a while and you want to get back into it. You don't have a little time, so you can scale down the difficulty level. All of these kind of mix and matching is perfectly fine with me. I really don't see an issue or a problem here.
Yeah, like a newbie Civ gamer come onto the boards frustrated about certain things, but I've never really heard any sort of sense that, oh no, I'm only playing at noble. What's wrong with me? This game is making me feel inferior. You just don't get a sense of what the rankings mean, if anything, until you actually spend a lot of time in the forums and get a sense of how the community plays and importance that is attached to that by some people. Otherwise, it's not a big deal.
I was able to relate more closely with Pie Master simply because, if for no other reason than he mentions playing on the level that I play on now, which is Prince. I play on Prince and find that quite hard. Very occasionally I win. Sometimes I've involved in good games but ultimately lose, and other times I just get blown out of the water. But how does the existence of the deity and immortal levels hurt me in any way? It wouldn't even matter if there were 15 higher difficulty levels than Prince. I'm never going to see them. Big deal, quote unquote, and I feel exactly the same way.
Me three.
Beeblebrox replied to that in particular and said, and you are content with that. In that respect, I believe you are unusual. Leaving the majority of players firmly fixed at the level below average will, in my opinion, harm Civ in the long run, quote unquote.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Because all of you suck, you're going to bring down Civ's overall quality? No, that hasn't been true through the whole... How many years now? 20 years almost that this has been around?
Yeah. Wow. Think about it for a moment, Beeblebrox. So let's say you buy anything. You buy a particular product, whether it's an appliance, you buy some food, you buy a computer, whatever it happens to be. Are you more likely to be vocal if you are satisfied or dissatisfied? Based on the experience not only on Civ Fanatics, but Politan and the new We Play Civ over the weeks, months, years, just as what Zyder was saying, and Mackie as well, these must be quite the silent majority, and they must be muffling themselves with their hand and their face getting all red and biting their tongue to the point that it's almost bitten off, because if people really felt that way, I think the boards would be full of people cursing the game left, right, and center.
To go back to your appliance analogy, it's like saying if I don't always separate my whites and my darks, I'm bringing down the quality of washers everywhere. Come on. They are not going to dumb it down just because everyone doesn't play at that level. The fact that they've added so many more difficult levels, when it used to be there was only 5 difficulty levels in Civ 1, they've added more difficulty levels to cater to the very people who want to play that hard, but they've left all the lower levels intact for those of us that don't have the time to get quite that micromanagey good.
And these games are so largely individual. I don't think the multiplayer will ever be the majority of the games that happen. People don't have to always play multiplayer. However, that means that everybody's playing on an individual effort. Nobody cares what level I play on. Nobody cares what I'm doing, if I win or not. I don't understand the whole thing that the Civ community will crumble because I am not playing on deity level every time I play. And calling me below average makes me feel really bad and want to punch him.
Get in line, sister.
At one point in the thread, Napalm102, who hadn't said anything at that point, had said, well, after reading the whole thing, here's my take. For a game, balance is more important than realism or historical accuracy. Keep in mind that once you have played through the game once, you basically have foreknowledge of what is to come when you play next. just the fact that you can see your tech tree and plan what Discovery is going to come next, and you can pretty much throw the whole real history argument out the window. And then the difficulty of the game is a fine balance. Make it too hard and nobody plays. Make it too easy and people get bored. So find your own niche and play there, and leave the higher difficulty levels to those who are prepared to invest time needed to learn the game, quote unquote. I don't know if I'd say to learn the game, but invest the time needed to
master those higher levels.
Yes. Get into the real nooks and crannies and get into the some real micromanagement.
Yeah, the spreadsheets and the crazy stuff like that.
Usually, side of historical accuracy, but usually that's because of pragmatism. Like, it makes sense to have this discovery come after this discovery, etc., and practicality and things like that. I don't think that historical accuracy is more important than game balance, because otherwise, what is the point? And I enjoyed the aspect of game balance that we have, whether or not everything is historically accurate or not. I think the pieces that we can play with, like my husband likes to do with like outfits and leader heads that are not necessarily will play into game balance but make it more historically accurate, those are the things that we like to play with.
If you wanted something a little more, well, not really historical, but, you know, he's talking about how you, once you play the game, once you can pass through the tech tree, well, if maybe in Civ 5 they threw in a blind research option like Alpha Centauri, where you can only determine the general direction and not exactly what, like, early on, say, I want military techs, and that would lead you, say, towards bronze working and iron working, or I want cultural techs, that would lead you towards the religious techs, or something like that.
More of a natural progression.
Yes.
And I think a lot of times, speaking for the historical people, it's not that we want historically accurate. We always want to play the game just like history happened. We like to rewrite history. We're starting over. We're making it the way we wanted it to be.
Yeah, with the general direction, like in Alpha Centauri, it's kind of like going into Civ 4 and telling the governor, concentrate on science. So I'm not telling you later on in the game, for instance, build a library here and build a research lab, so on and so forth. Just concentrate on that, just that kind of general direction. If you want something in between knowing the tech tree in Civ 4 and that, in Galactic Civilizations too, depending upon which civilization you choose, for instance, your technology tree is different. I'm not saying necessarily this would work for Civ proper, but it certainly could be perhaps a mod that, oh, I played with this civilization and that tech tree had some overlap, but there were definitely some things that I could research that other Civs could not research, and I think that's not just based on your civilization, but also your alignment, your moral alignment, whether you're kind of good, bad, or in between. Although we kind of have that in sort of a way now. Not quite the same technological progression. We know the technology tree, but thanks to unique units and unique buildings, it's not simply, well, my gameplay in all the same settings, if I chose the Americans or the Romans, it's going to be the same. It can be different because, hey, Romans, Iron, Praetorians. In any event, Beeblebrox, I suspect you have high blood pressure and may want to consult a doctor. Or at least try some deep breathing.
You say he should research meditation?
Carrots Ridiculous, question mark, says GHP stage. There are two major things with carriers that seem utterly broken to me. They can stack unlimited air power in a single tile enough to overwhelm any AI's air defense regardless of how advanced they are. This in itself is crazy enough. And then two, they can also have planes flying into and out of them to any point on the map in a single turn, and I'm 90% certain these cannot be intercepted. Combined, these things allow for some ridiculous abuse. And then it continues, don't get me wrong, I love abusing them. It just seems ridiculous that massing fighters and carriers will pretty much guarantee victory, even at seemingly unwinnable tech production population disadvantages, and even on most land-heavy maps. As McGarrick points out, you can only have 3 fighters per carrier, and they can be intercepted. Bombers cannot be placed on carriers. I think the most simple answer, though, is from Shackle. And that's when every other naval air unit comes into play. But I do fail to see a problem here, just like Volpik says. Besides carriers only having 3 fighters, so only 3 fighters, without a naval escort of some other units, battleships or missile cruisers or submarines or destroyers, they're kind of vulnerable out there. I very rarely use carriers, as a matter of fact. Now, admittedly, I also tend to play on maps that are more land-based than naval-based, even in Beyond the Sword. So put that into context. Carriers, wow, they are consistently the one naval unit I pretty well ignore 99% of the time. Which you could then say itself is maybe a problem.
Dan, I think you're playing on maps that are too land heavy. You don't have to have everything go across an ocean for three or four turns, in which case carriers for cover and scouting are great. And then when you get there, you can bomb the crap out of them.
Just defend them, just like you would your transports. Your settlers early on in the game.
Well, the AI is a lot better at Navy building than it used to be, so.
Yeah, if only it didn't stash all of its units in one port, though, like, you know, the Mian team always points out. Now, that's like a surefire tactic, basically, to thwart their naval counterattack.
It's like a big target. Point nuke here.
That would be interesting. If the AI knew how to use carriers, you would have duels between huge carrier stacks of death, just like you do with land ones, but fortunately it hasn't quite gotten there yet, although pretty decent AI otherwise. The modern war, it just becomes so complicated that it's hard for the computer to keep track, I think.
Yeah, it's good at using massive naval stacks and massive land stacks, but it still hasn't quite caught on to the fact that a massive bomber stack will do a lot more damage in the long run.
Yes, and so for that reason, for game balance, it's good that you cannot have bombers on carriers.
Oh, God. I mean, you've got to realize, too, that even if you have carriers for the initial amphibious assault, the defender's still going to have lots of cities inland with bombers and all sorts of things, artillery with transported by railroads to counterattack that beachhead. So, I mean, using fighters to get the beachhead is just the start of your problems when if you're really fighting a tech parity AI with similar or better production, you know, that's the least of your worries, seems like to me.
What I thought was a more interesting point in this thread, even in the opening post, is someone who's supporting GHP stage here, Roland Johansson, who said that, I'm not saying, for instance, that it's weird that you can stack 10 carriers on a tile. I'm saying it's weird that you can place more fighters in a sea tile than a land tile. My point is that Beyond the Sword introduced an arbitrary limitation to the air power concentration on land and didn't provide a similar limitation to air power on sea. Thus, the limitation doesn't really work. And I hadn't actually thought of that point before. In that case, that would force people to have, I guess what the opening poster was saying, multiple stacks of Doom where you couldn't just have everything moving on one tile. You'd have to spread it out, which could be an advantage anyway.
I'm not sure what the initial motivation was for the land air unit limit, but it might have something to do with what some of the posters pointed out with how the land intercepting unit, or interception in general, doesn't really work as well as one might expect, where you hardly ever actually kill a enemy fighter that you intercept. But maybe you could take away the limit and then just beef interception strength. I don't know.
Yeah, that's another option. One way or the other, however we want to change that and keep the gameplay balance. It's fine by me. Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. Last episode, we mistakenly said that civil service permits farming without irrigation in Civ 4. CS permits spreading of farming with irrigation. Or without irrigation, that requires biology farther down the technology tree. Thanks to Rough Hive for keeping us on our toes. Break with tradition here. We'll let our guests choose which one of the regular co-hosts he would like to hear do the closing.
Let's have Matt Kahlua do it.
It's because Dan planted a hypnotic suggestion before you started talking. That's how that works. Well, this has been episode 70 of Polycast. Thanks for listening. I'm still Matt Kahlua, and I was joined by Dan Quick.
Yes, you were.
Cardamandoa.
Bye.
And Cider.
See y'all later.
first-time guest co-hosting, but I guess you end up taking Imran's place.
Are there going to be any special responsibilities, or...
Pretend you don't play Civ.
Record date?
May 30th, 2009.
Civilization 4, Warlords, and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009 Civilized Communication at civcom.net.